hubbardnewsradio.com.
This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of resource constraints and evolving security threats, it becomes ever more critical to have leaders that recognize the information component of national power, leveraging information and information technology for strategic advantage. These leaders must be agile and adaptable to meet the national security challenges facing government today and into the future. The National Defense University's iCollege seeks to prepare such leaders, developing the skills, tools, and strategies so they envision and create the future. How is the National Defense University's iCollege expanding its mission as a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders? How is the iCollege continuing to enhance its global perspective? And what is the iCollege doing in the area of cybersecurity and cyber leadership? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the Information Resources Management College, or iCollege, at the National Defense University. Bob, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back.
Thank you, Michael.
Bob, I'd like to provide our listeners with some context about your organization, which I believe is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Would you provide a brief overview of the history, mission, and evolution of the Information Resources Management, or iCollege, which is part of the National Defense University?
Okay, we're really looking forward to our 25th anniversary, which I'll mention later, but the last 25 years has been a real journey. We started out as the Department of Defense Computer Institute, and then we were supposed to change that and really take a look at how information would influence government, leaders, countries, and how it would be a very important competency that senior leaders would need. So it was moved from the Navy Yard over to the National Defense University. And we started out with a number of courses, but it really took shape with the Clinger-Cohen Act in 1996. And that was a critical point because it gave structure to what we were doing. And we work with the congressional staffers in putting together the various competencies that were required. And then it's evolved into certificate programs, into a degree program in 2010, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Along the way, we have added industry students, international students, chairs from the interagency, and a number of things that way to really put us in the position that we're in today.
Well, Bob, how you kind of hinted at it a little bit, but how is the iCollege organized, and what's the size of its budget, number of folks that that work at the institution, and how has it grown both institutionally, but more importantly, physically, over the last quarter century?
Okay, we really function like a civilian university, more so than the rest of National Defense University. We have students that come and go. The other major colleges at National Defense University are centered around the 10-month program. The students come in August and they depart in June, and they have a 10-month curriculum that leads to a master's program. Our program is more open-ended. We include distributed learning, online learning. Students can combine that with in-residence classes. So we have students coming and going. So we have to have a registrar function. We have a student affairs branch. Our budget, our direct budget, is about $9 million, but that does not include the building costs, military. I would guess the cost, if you put it all together, would be around $15 million. We have lost considerable resources here within the last 24 months. We've gone from about 85 people down to 60. We've done things at the university. We're doing a lot of consolidations, student affairs with the rest of the university under a one university concept. We're pulling together various things like budgeting, student affairs. Different HR functions are being pulled together, logistical functions, things of those sort. So we've taken a pretty good hit. Now, the interesting thing is we actually have increased our student output. And you might say, well, what did you do? Did you have a lot of fat before? Well, the answer to that's no. What we did, we've actually taken our courses and we've lessened the options for students. In other words, you might have had five options before for classes. Now you might, if we offered a course five times a year, we might offer it three now. If we had five electives that you could take, maybe we have three now. So the customization is a little bit less, but what you've done is you've increased the capacity and output. If I had 14 in the class before, I may have 17 or 18 now. So we've had cost savings and efficiencies that way. But it has put demands on the staff, very, very tough demands. And sequestration and furloughs have played a role in that. It's very, very difficult to manage when every agency is doing it differently. If I'm conducting a week-long course, how do I know if your agency is doing Thursday and Friday, Friday, this week, next week, and every agency is different? So we've had to make arrangements with the different agencies. So it's taken a lot of extra work to schedule around sequestration and furloughs.
Well, what about the students? Who is eligible to enroll, and what's the composition of your student population?
The student body is 70% Department of Defense, and 70% of that are civilians.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, when you last joined us, your title was, senior director. I think you had become chancellor shortly before you joined us. I want to know a little bit more, what was the impetus for becoming chancellor? And perhaps you could tell us more about your specific responsibilities.
Well, I can tell you the exact moment where the title came. Admiral Rondo was the president of the university, and she and I were returning with the provost and my academic dean from testifying before the Department of Education to get us the degree-granting authority for our master's degree. And we were coming back, and we had had an ambassador over at the Eisenhower School who had had to take over for the commandant. And they were trying to determine a name, and they came up with chancellor. And she said, well, now, Bob, she said, you really ought to be a chancellor for a number of reasons. One, you're now a degree-granting institution. And if you take a look at universities, senior directors are not really heads of institutions. Also, the international impact, and we were doing, under Admiral Rondo, we were doing an awful lot of international outreach. So I was literally traveling and meeting with ministers of defense in different countries. I was working with universities who had the title of chancellor. And your title makes a big difference in international relationships and who you meet and the level you get into. So she thought that was really important. Plus, we were the largest school in total number of students at National Defense University. So she thought that title was far more appropriate than senior director. And it has had a big impact. I have to admit, you are definitely treated differently because of title.
And your role is really your strategic vision, basically? You set the division for the...
My role is what any executive would have, but basically, it's strategy, it's vision, it's outreach, it's connections. I'm Mr. Outside.
But you brought up challenging, and I think I want to delve down a little bit into that with your duties and responsibilities. What are some of your top challenges that you face, and what are you doing to address them?
Obviously, the budget. That's number one, and that actually drives the other considerations. The first thing you have to worry about is the human side of things, and the... sequestration and the cuts that have taken place, people are unsettled. They're concerned about this. You've gone 3 years without pay raises. And one of the things that I've always tried to do is create an environment where people could be innovative and creative and then try to reward those people. As part of that, professional development is very, very important, particularly in the field that we're in. The shelf life of my faculty members' knowledge is a lot shorter than people that are teaching historical things or law or things of that sort. It's changing, as you know, extremely rapidly. The other thing that's being cut is our capability for, if you will, research and development. We're not exploring some of the things that we used to explore. We're doing it as much as we can. We have research assistants from colleges. These are young people that are in master's and doctoral programs, some undergraduate students. And that number has been cut back, and they do a lot of the work in our labs and everything, but we've had to cut back.
Well, Bob, you know, leading an organization, an educational institution like the iCollege, can be fraught with unanticipated or unexpected surprises. I was wondering, what has surprised you most recently in your role? And more importantly, since you've taken over, you've truly transformed the institution. And I want to know what surprised you and what makes a good leader?
Well, the speed of technological change, we all know about it, but it's amazing. The rise and fall of companies. One of the things that I do that's really helped me in my job is I pay a lot of attention to the stock market, and I subscribe to Motley Fool. And I read their reports on companies all the time because they have to analyze industries and everything, and they talk about first movers, and if you follow Clayton Christensen, disruptive technologies and everything. So the speed of technological change is number one. Number two is the number of people that are leaving the federal government in senior leadership positions. And every day I look up and somebody is leaving. So my concern is in the cyber area, and it's cyber leadership. We now have a lot of people making decisions that haven't grown up knowing all the things. They're kind of learning as they go. So I'm concerned about that area. As far as leadership, had a huge, huge impact on me was Dr. George Johnson, who's president of George Mason University. And he taught me to focus on a few good things. And that's the way he built George Mason. He also taught me to be disruptive. The next individual that comes to mind is Paul Gaffney, who is Vice Admiral President of National Defense University back about 2000. And currently he's finishing up presidency for 10 years at Monmouth University. What he taught me is support the people that work for you and create an environment where they can achieve success, give them a little guidance, give them support, but don't be on their back all the time with details. And he was really, really good at that. That went a long way. And there's one more individual I'd like to mention, and that's Coach Mike Krzyzewski down at Duke. And he taught me that you bring people in, you make a team. It's not about individuals. It's about the team. And he has a thing called next play. In other words, you make a mistake, you might analyze it, put it behind you, next play. Let's get on with it.
How is the National Defense University's iCollege expanding its mission as a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders? We will ask Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the iCollege at the National Defense University, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the iCollege at the National Defense University. So, Bob, setting the strategic course for NDU's iCollege, you have significantly increased the reach and impact of the institution. That goes without saying. I'd like to explore your strategic vision that you have for the iCollege. Could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, I'd like to go back to 2008, which was a critical point in our time. We sat down and we said, what has been going on at the college? Because we all get wrapped up in Operation Tempo and everything, and you're making decisions and doing things and offering courses and processing students. And we sat back and we reflected on what we were actually doing. And we were actually doing more than just educating. Mm-hmm. We were informing people and we were connecting. So we decided, okay, we literally brought out a map. And I was reminded the other day, I called a meeting of a few of my strategic thinkers. And they said, Bob, do you remember in 2008 when you pulled out a map and you pointed to it and you said, we're going to be on every continent within the next 5 years? And I did say that, but I said, let's leave out Antarctic because there's not a lot there. So we actually started that. And we talked about this before. A number of our students, our international students, and even our U.S. students that were stationed around the world, had said, you have to go out and get to leaders above our level. We think it's important, but you have to get to our leaders. And we decided that those people were not going to come to a course. And maybe we could even influence them to send more people to courses if we got out. So literally, we went around the world. And you know that story. Yes. We went to Singapore. We went to Dubai. We went to London. And what we started doing with this concept of being the global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders, you got to go out and talk to these people. We did a number of things. We started teaching it in Sweden at the War College. We developed a cyber reference curriculum for the war colleges or the defense colleges in NATO, and that was presented last year. So we gathered all this information, and it went right into our courses, lessons learned and everything like that. What's the strategy going forward? Well, we have to get through the Hunger Games first, and that is where we are today. It's rather interesting. I don't want to say decisions are being made without strategy in mind, but a lot of times we're getting the low-hanging fruit without a thought to what the strategy could be. That's dangerous because what you have to do is you have to look at the future trends and position yourself, as we've said, but you have to take a look at the resources that you have and shape your vision that way. We literally set goals, we set deadlines, and then we met those deadlines. We went after them. We measured what we could do.
I did want to talk to you about the master's degree program.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what prompted you to pursue that? And more importantly, Bob, are you folks going to expand on that?
The master's program today has about 300 people enrolled in it. Wow. We have 50-plus graduates. We just had the third class graduate. The program's growing. It's a government-focused leadership program, which makes it unique. And like I said, all the background and everything of the connections that we have, the people we have, and the people we bring in make it a very, very unique program. It's unique in the world, not just in Washington or in the country, in the world. We have people from all over the world that are continuously calling me wanting to do that. Well, anyway, number one, we're focused on quality in that program. So when you talk about expansion, the numbers are expanding. And you can specialize within that program.
You have concentrations.
We have concentrations. Okay. And cyber is becoming larger. It's actually small, the number of people enrolled now. But when you take a look at it, how many people have masters in cyber today?
You've always been ahead of the curve, I think, in the way you've looked at it.
Yeah. Now, there's another thing going on. Like, we do work with U.S. Cyber Command now, but basically Cyber Command is focused on network security and those type of things. So they come to our labs for that part of their instruction. The bigger part of what we do is the whole of cyber. And the whole of cyber, to me, is the policy implementation, governance, law, privacy, strategies, tools, private-public partnerships, all that. Now, we do have one program that we're working with the National Intelligence University for a cooperative master's degree.
When we talk about cyber, sometimes the layperson thinks that cybersecurity, cyber is only about security. But it's more than that. And you point that out in a couple of interviews. You pointed that out. I would like to talk to you about what you're doing in the area of cyber leadership, the cyber beacon, and why is it so important?
Okay. I think it's important. And you can go to a whole number of quotes if you want to. Keith Alexander has recently said, we have the greatest transfer of wealth in history going on. I had Deutsche Bank in visiting us. And they have people all over the world. They're senior executives all over the world, Malaysia, Indonesia, London, U.S. And they're very concerned about this. Okay. Of course, they have compliance concerns. As I said, we've had Lockheed and Northrop, and we've had UAE, and we've had South Korea and Japan coming in. Everybody is concerned about this. It's a global problem. And we've been very fortunate at NDU. We've had General Cartwright in to speak on this, and we had Secretary Lin when he announced the first U.S. policy. They did these at National Defense University. It seems to be a forum that people can get national policy out. And President Obama speaks there quite frequently and puts his policies out. Well, anyway, the cyber area, when you take a look at the world today, and I like to put things in boxes. Sometimes it helps a little bit. But you look at the digitization of our lives, our work lives and our private lives. Okay, Facebook, social. Okay, LinkedIn, professional. eBay, Amazon, buying. Google, search. Everything's digitized, okay? And we're moving more and more in that direction. I have eight pages of passwords of things that I have, okay? And you got to change those. Some of those you got to change all the time. And so I have a set at work and a set at home if I have to do things. Eight pages, okay? Anyway, you have to protect this stuff. But at the same time, look at what we can do. We can do everything. I don't have to go to the bank anymore. I don't have to do anything that way. You can do everything over the internet. We do business over the internet. I collaborate with people all over the world over the internet. So as Dave Winogrand used to say all the time, we need secure collaboration. The two have to go together. Yeah. So anyway, you have to get into all the different elements of this. And that's the problem and the challenge today. Every organization, not defense, not security, every organization.
Private sector
has
and
to be,
public. Alike.
And you do, yeah. And I do, yeah, sure. At home.
What did you do with the Cyber Beacon? How did that kind of help your efforts?
Cyber Beacon was a strategy. My feeling on things is sometimes you have to rally around things and pull things together. And times were hard. We weren't doing outreach. So I said, how can I get people together to talk about a topic without me calling 40 people up individually and talking to them? How can I get a synergy going? So about 9 months ago, we thought, let's do something called Cyber Beacon. And actually, I even imaged this thing. You have a beacon that's showing light on things, and you have ones and zeros out there. So we pulled people together and we said, okay, number one, we just don't want to talk about things. We want to talk about cyber leadership education. We want to look at what's going on. And we ran into a study that was fascinating. It's called One Leader at a Time. And it was a Pell study that was done by Francesca Spitaleri. And that was out of the Pell Center. And she says, one leader at a time, the failure to educate future leaders for an age of persistent cyber threat. And what she does, she takes a look at all the different elements, and on a Likert scale, she looks at all the top master's level institutions across the country, and she rates them on, do they have cyber law? Do they cover privacy? Do they cover compliance? Do they cover policy? And that's not to say one school or another school is not good, because some are extremely good in some areas but they don't cover other areas. There's nothing wrong with that. And she rated the schools. And two schools came out 3.5 or better. Georgetown, their foreign institute, came out there. And the other one was Carnegie Mellon, the Hines Business School up there. They were the only ones on a four-point Likert scale. Then she just, 30 July was supposed to be the release date. Joint Professional Military Education Institutions in an Age of Cyber Threats. And she goes out and she took a look at all the military schools that, once again, the Army War College, the National War College, things like that. And the National Defense University Eye College, our school, was the only one that was rated 3.5. So we felt very, very good about it. So Cyber Beacon, the intent was to bring people together to determine what should go into a cyber education and the current status of education. And what I wanted to do was benchmark what we had. So we didn't talk about ours. We talked about how we'd put it together. Okay. And I gave about 15 minutes introduction. Then I said, that's the last you're going to hear about us. We want to hear what everybody else thinks is going on.
Well, Bob, you know, we talked about cyber. We talked about the master's program. I'm wondering, how critical is it for the future national security leader to understand information strategies and related technologies? And more particular, getting back to your curricula, how do programs like the Government Strategic Leadership Program or the Advanced Management Program factor into doing this?
Okay, I think it's an area, as I've just said, it's pervasive across the government. Everything we do, and as we move more and more toward more collaboration, which sequestration and budget cutting is going to lead to, there's going to be more sharing that goes on. There's going to be more network security needed. There's more the Air Force under Terry Takai has come up with the joint information environment that we're going to have to operate in. And there's different levels, and people have to understand this. If they can't understand it, they can't make decisions. And a lot of it has to do with the culture of an organization, how you access information, how you analyze information, how you share information. And all leaders have to know this. And that's the one thing we're focused on. I guess the best example I could use is Steve Cooper. We invited him in for a luncheon, and he was asked what he thought of it by the team. And he said, hey, I serve as an adjunct and speak at a lot of colleges. He said, I'm here today taking courses. I come back to the Eye College when I want to know what's going on and what I need to know. So I think the program we have is so unique because it is whole of government approach. And I think that's the way we have to approach everything. Now, we can no longer be DOD. We can't be State Department. It's got to be whole of government. So I think that's one of the things that we do.
Mm-hmm. And these programs shape these the programs, leaders that are going to deal with that.
There's no one else really that matches what we do. I'm looking. I'm trying to get ideas from everywhere. And any of your listeners that are listening, call me and help me, because that was the purpose of Cyber Beacon. Tell us what we're not doing that we should be doing.
How is the National Defense University's Eye College continuing to enhance its global connections? We will ask Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the Eye College at the National Defense University, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the Eye College at the National Defense University. So, Bob, the iCollege at NDU promotes global connectedness through a diverse student body and opportunities to communicate with information leaders from around the world. You've pointed that out in our conversation. Would you tell us more about your international outreach? How do you build capacity in that regard? And what are some of the best practices you've shared?
Okay, I would say the first thing are our visitors to National Defense University as a whole. The number of visitors, international groups that come through, is huge. I want to say it's over 200 a year. One of the things that we did, as I mentioned earlier, we've worked with NATO and the defense colleges there in building a cyber reference curriculum. They actually came to us and they knew we were doing a lot. And they said, can you put something together? If we want to design a curriculum, what should we look at? Okay, should we look at law, compliance? And if we do, what are the topics? So Dr. John Christian for us took care of that. Some of the things that we're doing now, we have a conference that's coming up. We're working with the French American Foundation in October. And they have a private session for a couple days, and then they have an open forum that's larger. And we're putting that on the 4th of October. And we're going to take some of the things that we learned from Cyber Beacon and put that in that area. In November, CENTCOM is having a big conference. And it's supposed to be a lot of issues, but it's going to focus on cyber. And last year we participated, and there were a lot of questions that were directed at me as the chancellor of the iCollege, like, Dr. Childs, you've been one that hasn't talked about policy. You've offered us something. And that's important. These countries are looking for leadership. They look to the U.S. I've talked to Madeleine Creedon, who is the Assistant Secretary for Strategic Alliances in DOD. And she's talked about that. A lot of countries want to deal with the United States, but it's like anybody else. You have to have a common understanding of things. So we're trying to help in that area. We have six students coming in to our 14-week program starting in September. We have one from Brazil. We have one from Armenia. We have one from Taiwan. We have a couple from Pakistan coming in. We just graduated in the master's program an individual from the Czech Republic. So we're building relationships this way. My academic dean, Dr. McCauley, has been invited over to Romania. And you may remember we helped Romania develop a Chief Information Officer Academy. So we've kept those relationships alive. We're in touch with Peter Ho. Back from our first conference, he was the head of civil service. He's now head of critical national infrastructure in Singapore. So we've contacted him to see how we can work out that way. We're working with the centers at NDU. We've got a Center for Hemispheric Studies who has us working with Peru on a possible conference.
Well, Bob, you've done a lot with the iCollege, and we talked a lot about it today, the number of transformations you've shepherded, and you're a real champion for the iCollege, and it's been recognized. I think it's unprecedented. For 5 years running in total, you have been recognized by the Fed 100 Award. Could you tell us a little bit more about this recognition? What have you done to consistently achieve in this area?
I've gotten recognized because of the smart people that work for me. I think the head of organizations either receive the credit or the blame for good or bad. And that's just the way it is. And you know, you stand on the backs of those people that have gone before you and that support you. And I've got very smart people. What I will take credit for is hiring good people. And not only hiring them, you have to get a critical mass, and this is another thing I learned from Mike Krzyzewski. If you read his books, and I've had a chance to personally talk to him, you can be greater than the sum of your parts. He talks about the fist and how strong the fist can be, but if you break it into fingers, you know, it can be fairly weak. And he also talked, one time I wrote him a letter, and I was very impressed. He wrote back to me, and I've kept that. And it was, I get passionate when I watch sports. I mean, you don't want to watch a game with me. I yell at the TV set. I throw things, you know. And Duke basketball is one thing, you know, Redskins football, Washington Nationals. Anyway, what you try to do is you try to get a critical mass. And that's what he told me in a letter. He said, what I need is a critical mass. I need players that are competing for playing time. In other words, if I show up and I know I'm playing all the time and I don't have to put out, yeah, I may do okay. But if I know every time I show up at practice, I'm competing for playing time the next night or a couple nights downstream, you're going to have a more competitive, better team, ultimately, particularly if you work together. And I'd mentioned that earlier about you don't have a star can evolve, but you need your role players to support those people. So hiring the right people and getting them doing the right job and then recognizing them and letting them run is a big thing. So you create that environment for them. You give them a general direction, and that's what Paul Gaffney was at. Paul would give you a general direction. Mike Dunn, who followed Paul Gaffney as president, he was big on outreach. Okay, so that was his general direction. Lieutenant General Wilson, Fran Wilson, followed Mike. And she was big on international outreach. She went with the international students and really did a lot for this country in building relationships with the international students. And then she was followed by Admiral Rondo, who really started working with, in particular, the Asian countries, the ASEAN conference of all them and pulling them together. And that was followed through. General Martin went to that conference this year. The year before, Admiral Rondo had hosted it. Well, anyway, you give people the general direction and then you can take the lead. And fortunately, I've worked for people that have given me the latitude. You know, I look at the general lead and I don't need any more guidance. You know, I can fall under that and align myself with that. And then you got to celebrate successes. And I guess that's the hard thing. We're about to come on our 25th anniversary, which is sponsored by the NDU Foundation. And that's important to us. I talked about the 20th. Mm-hmm. The last 5 years are what I would consider the Camelot experience for the college. I mean, we've reached a pinnacle of international recognition and reputation that has had a washback on all of National Defense University. We've built relationships. We've brought in technologies. We've brought in partners and everything that will have a lasting impact. So the big question now is, where do we go from here? It's the old S-curve. When you're at the top, how do you stay there? When do you jump to the next part in the S-curve? And literally, that's what we're trying to do now. We've kind of evolved into this cyber leadership thing. And right now, we are right there. We may not be recognized as that yet. In fact, we actually have discussions with the joint professional military people saying, you need to be more like us. And my argument is, no, you need to look at your content. And what's more important, what you've been teaching or cyber? Where's the world going? Is Keith Alexander right? Is Lieutenant General Mike Flynn right over in the intelligence area? You know, is Clapper right? You know, is McConnell right? Who's right in this area? And I think leadership, the problem with leadership today is, like myself, most leaders have grown up in the era where cyber wasn't important and we're kind of trying to learn it, but we're the ones making the decisions. Okay. The problem with the youth is they don't understand the political implications of the decisions that they make in this area. So you have a real gap. Somehow you have to bring that together, and hopefully we can do that. I don't have an answer yet, but I'm trying to figure out how. Oh, I'm concerned about it, really.
Well, Bob, there's two other things before we close this segment that I find very unique about getting back to the curricula is the CFO Academy and your labs. Really, you wouldn't expect an iCollege, even though I know you go beyond information leaders, to house a CFO Academy.
Okay. To make a long story short, Danny Werfel and Tina Jonas, who was DOD comptroller, Danny was OMB.
Controller.
Yeah. Wanted to establish a strategic school for chief financial officers. And I use the word strategic. They had great budget schools within the services. The problem with a budget person, they look at a budget and they say, here's where we can cut, here's where we can save, here's what we can do, here's what this costs. Sometimes you have to put costs up front to get things done. We all know the saying, you can pay me now or pay me later. We all know that the acquisition process is built for large military systems. It's not designed for information technology. And looking at the competencies of a chief financial officer and the CIO, they're pretty similar. And these two people, if you think about it, the CFO and the CIO are supposed to both be at the table, although CIOs are not at the table as much as they should be. We have that situation. So we thought putting them in the classroom, and it's really worked. They're learning, CIOs and CFOs are learning so much from each other. Now, the third leg of the triangle, which I haven't completed and budget has stopped me, is the chief human relations officer. That was going to be my triumvirate, because that's the third part you have to get in there, because it's budget, personnel, and IT that drive all costs and decisions. But I haven't gotten to that point. But if you also look at the dime concept, the dime concept, and we teach this at all the schools, the diplomatic, informational, military, and economic part of power, a nation's power. But if you look at the I part, information, it's right in the middle. If you look at Arab Spring, diplomatic. You know, you look at military, secure system. Drones are replacing fighter aircraft and everything. And the economics, we talked about the banks and everything that's going on there in the financial system. So the I, it almost is a smaller D and a huge I. And so that's why positioning the college, I talked about positioning and how critical it was. You can kind of see how that works.
And offering these programs really make it that way.
It really does. And putting the people together. Some people said, well, why did you get the CFO Academy? It doesn't make any sense. And I said, you got to go back and look at the history. If you look at the history, it makes total sense. To pull it out would not be a smart move. In fact, that was a discussion during the budget cutting exercises. Oh, yeah, they talked about pulling it out from us and possibly putting it at another school or something. That just didn't make sense to the comptroller. You know, we talked to Mr. Hale about that, and he wasn't for that at all.
What does the future hold for NDU's iCollege? We will ask its chancellor, Dr. Robert Childs, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
What would happen if time became a key performance metric in government efficiency and effectiveness? What is fast government? How can we develop strategies and tools to deliver fast government? What are the barriers to innovation, speed, and performance? Join host Michael Keegan next week on a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Fast Government, accelerating service quality while reducing cost and time. Tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the iCollege at the National Defense University. So, Bob, in some quarters, there's a perception that government lags behind the private sector in innovation. First, do you think this perception is accurate? And second, how do you think the government can enhance its position to become a leader and driver of innovation?
Well, as I said earlier, I think we have to get beyond the Hunger Games. And the Hunger Games is where we are now. And until that comes to an end, I think it's going to be difficult. Okay. Because what do you typically cut? You cut R&D and education. The two things you probably need both. If a company cuts those areas, they're in trouble. I mean, take a look at any company that cuts R&D. Now, on a note, looking at companies, my perception of Apple, I think Apple's going to come back. I told you I study the stock market, and I look at companies, and you learn a lot from companies. And I can't understand, except for leadership, and you want to talk about leaders, and this is one thing I didn't mention, is Steve Jobs when he led Apple, okay? He was a great marketer, okay? That's what they've lost, losing him. Plus, they also lost the perfectionist that could sell the product. They still have smart scientists and everybody, engineers, putting stuff together. So I think they'll come out with products, and I think they'll come back. I mean, they have a PE of like 9 or 10 now. So when you start to get into it, they haven't cut their R&D is the point that I'm trying to make. But government has. DARPA's scaled back. They still do some stuff. But there used to be stuff that was spun off from NASA and other organizations. Now, do I think government's doing stuff? Yeah, because we have to. Mm-hmm. But I think where it's coming is in the people in the process.
Interesting.
I don't think it's coming in the technology area. Okay, the technology is coming from the private sector. Now, an interesting story. Where do I learn things and do things? Mm-hmm. I got invited to a meeting of Mark Andreessen and Chertoff and Alexander. And this was put on, I walked in and it was over at the museum, and this was about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago. And it was a bunch of venture capitalists that were being funded by the Andreessen Corporation. And that was fascinating to me. There were all these guys there. They may not have had much money. They may have been multimillionaires, but they were starting small tech companies, which get bought out by your Ciscos and your Apples and your Googles when they get going. But they were looking for funding, and that's what this corporation does. But listening to them talk, and I ran into some of the people you would guess. I ran into Mark Weatherford there. Okay, I ran into Vivek Kundra there, who works for Salesforce.com. But you ask me where I get ideas, I get ideas at places like that. I go out to places like that. I think that's where your ideas are going to come from. But the question is, we government people have to go out and find them. One time I heard somebody say, and I can't remember who, that they had 30 vendors a week that wanted to come in and see them. Well, we don't have time for that. You know, you just can't keep hearing vendors. And the problem is, if you really don't know the environment, how do you know what technology to pick? Mm-hmm. This is the problem with other countries. With the U.S., a lot of times the U.S. is guilty too. We'll buy a technology, but we really don't. We think we know what it's for. We haven't got the requirements right. We don't have the schedule right, whatever. And we get what we ask for, but we didn't ask for the right thing. You know, so it's interesting. But I think the innovation from the government has got to come from the cost cutting, and it's going to be people and processes. It's going to be cultural changes versus technology innovations.
Mm-hmm. As a result of, say, the budget austerity and what have you, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, as a result of that, clearly.
So you stay current and in touch with global technology pulse or trends by doing what you just suggested, by going to these events and... is there other ways that
you
can
connect? Well, going to events, reading... I find it fascinating looking at stocks. Like I listen to Cramer on TV at night and Mad Money, and then I go in on the internet and I find something, and it's kind of like wandering around the candy store or something. You start wandering through sites, and then you start reading. Like, okay, and then you find a company that sounds interesting, and you say, what business are they in? What are they trying to do? And then you put four or five of these things together. It's kind of like I stumbled onto LinkedIn. And then all of a sudden I started using it. And man, I was getting in touch with people that I wanted to get in touch with, but I couldn't get through to. Steve Cooper I'd lost touch with. I told you Steve was a good friend, but I'd been sending him emails. I didn't know he'd switched jobs, but all of a sudden it comes up on LinkedIn. Sent him a LinkedIn connection. Within 24 hours, within 6 hours, I had him. So you start looking at these technologies and you say, wow. And then if you start seeing a stock move, you start saying, hey, there's other people that are interested in this. So you start looking at it, and it kind of drives you to explore things. I think that's incredibly important. And then I think you need to think big, like, okay, where do I want to go? Like right now I say, I want to be international, but I can't go international. How can I maintain these contacts? So you start looking for technologies and ways, you know, that you can do this. So you have to figure out new ways to do things.
Well, that's a great transition into the future, finding new ways of doing things. So I was wondering, what are some of the major opportunities and perhaps challenges you at the iCollege will face over the upcoming years? And how do you envision your organization transforming to meet those challenges and seize opportunities?
Well, I would say we've gone through the biggest transformation now. Okay. We've had people retire. We've had people move on. I have to admit, I had a meeting about 12 months ago, could have been 18 months ago, and I a lot of people would say it was bad leadership, but I called people in and I said, look, here's what the environment looks like to me. I said, if you have another job opportunity you think is better, I would take it. I wasn't trying to drive people out, but I was trying to be honest. And that was my honest assessment. And I still feel that way. I think the next couple years, things are going to get worse before they get better. I mean, I'm following what the Secretary Hagel's saying. I'm following what the president of the National Defense University. We just have to get through it. We have to figure out, and we just have to keep positioning ourselves and sort out how to do it. Okay? So that's number one. Two, I think that we are so unique and we're an international force, I have to keep these relationships alive any way I can. Okay, so I'm constantly looking for ways. Calling people in, calling them on the phone, sending emails, finding out when they might be in this country, finding if we do have limited money, who do I send to a place and how can we get the very most out of this place? If somebody's going somewhere, I'm probably going to have them do four or five things rather than one thing. But I think the international scope, I think if we are not on top of things and international, you might as well close the doors. Mm. I honestly feel that way. That's what I would say. If somebody called me in and said, okay, we have to eliminate all your relationships in this and you hunker down and this is the one thing you do in life, I'd say it violates number one principle, which was be a niche organization and be the best in the world in doing it. If you can't do that, close the doors. Okay? We can do it, but you got to help us. Okay? So I'm looking for help. Now, another way to do that, we used to have a saying, OPM, other people's money. Okay? There are pockets of money that want to get things done. So how can you partner with those people or those organizations or whatever the purpose is that controls that money and get involved with it? Maybe you have to modify what you're doing a little bit. Maybe you have to do a few things different. You can't totally compromise what you're doing, but like anything else, you may have to compromise something, you know, to get from here to there. You know, and if you believe enough in what you're doing, you will survive the Hunger Games and come out on the other end. What you have to be careful of is you don't compromise everything and you come out
half of what you were before.
Yeah, because that doesn't work. That's not worthwhile.
You're a hollow shell at that point.
Exactly. You don't want to be in that position.
As once again, I mean, I always love having you in. It's chock full with great anecdotes. And as you reflect on your career in public service and education, what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in either?
I think in many ways the public sector is harder than the private sector. The government is not a take risk, be a bold organization. I mean, historically, it's not. It's a conservative organization. I've always been fortunate. I've had bosses that have had my back. Okay, I've done some things and reached out in areas that would make other people nervous. I mean, I'm not talking illegal things or anything like that, but I'm talking about